This is Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, and I'm initiating an oral history interview with Harold Anderson, who goes by Drew, and also with me in the room is Drew's nephew, Kevin Salisbury, who's also an employee of the Vietnam Archive, and today is the 7th of February 2006, and we're very honored to have you here, Drew, and thank you very much for being willing to participate in the Oral History Project. This is very important for us that we have an opportunity to document some of your service to the country. Let me ask you just a couple of basic biographical questions first, if you don't mind. Where were you born and when?
I was born in Hood County, Texas, and I forgot in about 1950 to renew my driver's license, and they wouldn't renew it until I produced the birth certificate.
Uh-huh.
And I was never named. I wrote to Austin, and I knew my mother's maiden name and my father's name.
Mm-hmm.
And so they sent, there was a baby boy born May the 22nd, 1916. But they didn't have a record of me being named. It was just a male child.
So, but that was you.
That was me.
Now, why did your parents not? Did they not have a name picked out for you? What did you hear about that later?
I can't. My parents were dead at that time.
Uh-huh.
The doctor did. Evidently sent that in.
He just filled in the form and sent it in.
Yeah.
Well, tell me a little bit about your parents. What did your dad do?
Oh, my dad was never anything but a farmer, and he was farmed in Hood County, Texas, till the boll weevils put an end to cotton farming, and so we moved to Lubbock on Christmas Day of 1922 was when we arrived in Lubbock.
And what was your father's plan? What did he plan to do in Lubbock?
Well, my grandfather, my mother's father, had. He and his boys had bought a section of land out about 2 miles east of where there's a canyon community out there. There's a gin there now.
Mm-hmm.
But they bought this. It was a section of land, but that's this strip land. That's where two surveys come together, and it wasn't. It wasn't quite a section.
It was
three boys and the old man, and they bought the section.
And were they planning to continue to farm?
Yeah.
And do cotton farming?
Yeah.
Dry cotton
farming.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is that what you grew up doing? Did you help out?
Yes, I've pulled several hundred thousand pounds of bulls in my life before I knew any better.
I can believe it. Did you think you might want to do something other than that?
I don't know. I didn't have any ambition other than. And farming, I thought that was. In fact, I volunteered for the Army because I wanted to get my year's service, which we were promised to get a year's service, and I'd be back at the first of the year to start another crop.
Now, so, you were what year was that that you volunteered?
In 1940, it was the draft had just started,
mm-hmm.
and there was one guy from our neighborhood went on that first early draft, and I thought, well, I'd like to go and get it over with, but before the first of the year, 1942, So I went up to the draft board, and I knew the man in charge.
Mm-hmm.
He says, "We ain't got no place to put you till after January. They're going to build tent cities at El Paso." So in the 23rd of January, I along with several hundred people went to Fort Bliss.
Now you went in and talked to the Army recruiter here
not,
in Lubbock.
No, not the Army recruiter.
I'm sorry.
Man in charge of the draft board.
Oh, the draft board. Well, that was here in Lubbock that you talked to.
Yes, in Lubbock.
Did you know who that guy was?
Yeah,
who was
Douglas
he?
Douglas Pounds.
Uh huh. Was he a businessman here in town? Or?
No, he was a farmer. In the Acuff community.
Oh, yeah.
I knew him well. I mean, we went to the same church.
Oh, is that right? Uh-huh.
And
now, what about your brothers? Were they also?
They are younger. Mm-hmm. They were both younger than I. And at that time, Doug was going to Texas Tech.
Mm-hmm.
You might mention his hero was the guy in the mathematics class. He was, the name escapes me,
it's okay.
But he was telling Doug that he says those people out here are digging in the ditches. They may be making more money than I am today, but he says the time they get as old as I am, so they'll be worn out, and I'm just in my prime. But I can't recall that man's name. But he was, there wasn't very many math teachers, that's what he taught,
mm-hmm.
in the engineering division. And he taught that for quite a long time.
Just for the accuracy of the record, your brothers were how much younger than you?
Doug was 4.5 years younger than I, and the other one was 11 years younger.
Oh, okay,
than
so they
the one that died, he died at 55.
Mm-hmm. So they were separated by quite a bit of time.
Well, there's two girls in between.
Well, I was going to ask you, anybody else in there?
Well,
so you have a couple sisters,
there
too.
There was six of us. And four of us still get together.
That's terrific. That's excellent. And one of those sisters is your mom, is that right, Kevin?
Mm-hmm.
And which sister?
Mary.
And
next to the baby. She's just older than one.
Okay. Just next, she's the next to youngest then. Okay. And your mom still lives here in Lubbock.
She's a native of Lubbock. She and John were both born in Lubbock County. The rest of us was imported.
So, Drew, let me ask you about that time when you went in to talk to the fellow at the draft board.
Mm-hmm.
How much did you know? How much were you following international events? Were you aware?
Yeah, I knew that the Congress had passed a selective service. And it was just going to be for 1 year, and I don't know what in this day and age, but my dad owned 80 acres out by Idaho, but that wasn't enough for one family. But it always rented the. From the January the 1st to December the
mm-hmm.
31st. When I went to Michigan, it always starts April the 1st, but that's just the difference.
Yeah, they got to wait for things to thaw out up there.
Yeah, that's right.
Were you?
But I'm not going to mention that long about that time, Sam was just starting to roll in this country.
Oh, yeah. Well, that would be hard work. I can't imagine how hard it must have been for a family to make do on cotton farming out here. Was your mom quite good at running the home and so on? Can you tell me about her?
My mother was an angel.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can swear to that.
Well, yes, sir.
What was her name?
Martha Elizabeth Hufstetler. That was her maiden name.
Mm-hmm.
And she was, that Hufstetler, you know, is German.
Sounds like it.
They were very ambitious.
Was she born in Texas? Was she a native Texan?
Yes, and all of her ancestors on both sides came from Arkansas.
Is that right? Huh.
But they came to Texas I guess just after the Civil War. I think they were in Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember my great-grandmother telling me about her father. Her husband. I remember him well. Mm-hmm. We lived on their place in 1922. And she always had to milk the cows because he says, I just, when I catch a hold of a cow's teat, why, he says the milk just goes back up into the... That was his story, and his wife was stuck with it.
Yeah. It got him out of that.
And he drove an ox team from Arkansas to Hood County, Texas. And there's some dry camps made, and oxen can smell water for a long time, and they got close to, I'm not sure what river it was, but they just, he was walking along beside with a pole.
Mm-hmm.
They took off and ran to the creek or river.
Yeah.
And went right out in the middle of it to drink, and he with his ox cart and all the possessions was... So I think when he got them out, he traded for a team of mules. My great grandmother, he died while we lived on that farm.
Mm-hmm.
And tenant farmers.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember her saying, I never heard Arch swear but once. And he was wearing a full beard, and he was robbing the bees, and the bees got into into his beard, and he says to him, goddamn bees. I think he can be forgiven.
I think, yes, I think that we'll let that one go. He was provoked. Well, Drew, let me ask you about... What did you know about Hitler? Had you heard of him?
Oh,
much?
Yeah, we had a radio.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anybody of my generation was sucked into that war that we wasn't 100% behind it. We subscribed to the daily paper, and Dad had a radio. He spent all his time listening to the war news, so we were informed.
Yes. And what did you yourself think? Did you think it was heading for war? You knew that was coming?
No, I really didn't. I thought this after I got in the war in from January of 41, I didn't keep up with the news then because I was for the brass to do whatever they right. told me I was going to do it.
Sure enough,
but there was really no resentment in I joined this National Guard. 124th Cavalry mm-hmm. was back in the late 30s. Oil in the East Texas was selling for $1 a barrel, and they were having riots in East Texas, and they formed this 124th Cavalry to fight the riots over the oil field. Now, I know nothing about that mm-hmm. because we was a long ways from there, but I do know that's a fact, that oil was selling for $1 a barrel.
And that was what was causing the riot?
Yes, yeah. I know there was people that didn't want to they wanted to, I guess they thought if they produced a million barrels a day at $1 a barrel, the government was trying to keep the production down mm-hmm. so the price wouldn't be so low, and I sure am not an authority on that. After the war, well, then economics took over, and but in the Depression, that fact of producing oil at $1 a barrel, it just won't wash.
Yeah. Well, it seems strange now because it's gone, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
It's, what is it, $60 a barrel or something now? It's $50 is common,
$60. Oh, yes, if it went down to $50, we'd
be happy.
Yeah.
Yeah, we could fill up the gas tank.
I think it's 65 or something like that.
Drew, you when you entered the service, were you sworn in here in Lubbock before you went down to Fort
That's
Bliss?
Right.
Do you remember that? Do you remember being sworn in?
Sure.
Can you tell me about that, the ceremony? Where was it? Where were you here in town? Where was it?
Oh, it was downtown, uh-huh. and I'm not sure what building it was in. It could have been a depot. It was right downtown,
mm-hmm.
and we had two or three depots then.
Yeah.
And I don't remember when we were sworn in. They had sent a corporal from El Paso, Fort Bliss, to herd us down there. And of course, I thought that corporal was probably the first cousin to a general.
Right.
he didn't have any trouble taking a carload of us down there.
But how many were you? How many men?
I can't tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was I think it was just one passenger car load.
Okay. Was that a proud day for you? Did you feel good that day? Was it a proud day or apprehensive?
I didn't think I was going off and save the world. It was just a job to be done, and I didn't.
You're just getting on with it. You were just going to get on with it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right.
Mm-hmm. So you drove all the way down to Fort Bliss in this car?
Train. We was on the train.
Oh, you went on the train.
We had to go to... We started at East, and I'm not sure whether it was... I believe it was to Sweetwater. We went to Sweetwater and then caught another train that turned around and went to El Paso.
Mm-hmm.
It took us all night to get to El Paso, and man, that Fort Bliss, they had pitched tents out there and piled up rocks and tons of them, and that's what they set us to doing, was moving those rocks from one location to another. Person, they did have carts for us to load them into, but it kept us out of mischief.
Yes, sir. Did they set you up with accommodations in those tents? Is that where you stayed?
That's where we stayed.
How many men to a tent?
I think it was six. Six cots in there.
And what kind of equipment and uniform? Did they give you all that? Did they set you up with that?
Yeah, that's... they even give us an overcoat there. GI shoes and... But we didn't stay there a couple of weeks till this 124th Cavalry that had been it had been pressed into national service, and most of the guys was from Houston and the surrounding area.
Uh-huh.
But they had come up to Fort Bliss. God knows why, but I guess it come after us, because there was all of these people from Lubbock joined that National Guard, and I lost track of most of them, because there was 11 of us went to this special weapons troop. And when I signed up for this, I thought, well, now, can I remember? There was 11 of us, I know that. And mm-hmm. I started writing their names down, and said, golly, I couldn't come up with that last name, and then it was mine. I recall all of these other people, but I was on there too.
Now, this was when you were kind of brought into the 124th at this point?
At
Bliss?
At Fort Bliss, uh-huh. That's right.
And did they give you some weapons training while you were there?
No. They give us just a little bit while we were at Fort Bliss, marching, and they didn't issue us any guns there,
uh-huh.
And we. But I don't believe it was 2 weeks until they loaded us up on the train. First time I'd ever been on a Pullman car,
uh-huh.
and we went to Fort Brown at Brownsville.
And what happened there? More training, or did you have to actually go out and do some?
Well, us recruits, mm-hmm. we had. I think that it was 6 weeks training we were supposed to get, but I think that we didn't get that much. I think this moving from one from Fort Bliss down there, I think they counted that in, and so So we joined the troops.
And when you say you joined the troops, where was that? Still at Fort Brown?
Still at Fort Brown. Mm-hmm.
And
see, they treated the recruits different for a few weeks.
Uh-huh. And that was kind of the training period.
Yeah.
Yeah. And did they give you more weapons training down there?
Not at that time. Mm-hmm. Not at that time. Mm-hmm. We probably marched carrying the .03 rifles, which was a bolt action, which probably the most accurate rifle that they had until maybe present days might be more accurate, but about midway in my service, why they took the .03 bolt action guns away, and they had it was a semi-automatic weapon that they armed the troops with in the
yeah.
First World War. Sometimes we went out on the firing range for a couple of weeks, and that was at Brown, and some hurricane back in the 70s obliterated that. It's the last time I was down there, it was that our old rifle range was underwater.
Gone, yeah.
The targets mm-hmm. were up on a like old-fashioned basketball backboards, mm-hmm. you know, that stuck up like that.
Mm-hmm.
The last time I was down there, you could see them, but the ocean had obliterated our training field. See, it was in 1970 or so that they had quite a hurricane down there.
Mm-hmm.
And this was in the 90s that I was there last, and they obliterated our...
That's a funny feeling, I bet. Well, did the 124th have a mission down there at Brown, or were you primarily...
They had barracks there. That was just...
Uh-huh.
And after the war started, there was a cavalry replacement training center in Fort Riley, Kansas, and they put thousands of people through that. But that was just basic training. And then, really, this 124th was down there, and they would send their graduates from Fort Riley down there, and we had all of Texas to maneuver in. We were riding horses. We rode,
yes, sir.
We rode horses from Fort Brown, right at the tip of Texas, up to Laredo, which is 210 miles or so, several times. There was another cavalry post at Ringgold, mm-hmm. which there's a little town there, but the name escapes me, but... the last time I was down there, which has probably been 30, 40 years ago, they was using these old barracks for Mexican labor were living
right?
in there. Mm-hmm. And I we went, it was a Ford. I just mentioned it before. It's about 200 miles.
Laredo?
Laredo. Uh-huh. And then we one time we rode out to Marfa. And that's in the Big Bend country.
Yes, sir.
And we were supposed there was colored troops in Fort Huachuca in Arizona, uh-huh. and they were going to meet us there for maneuvers, but they washed out. They sent them somewhere for labor to probably into India or. We got to Burma, there was airfields there that were they had black troops running these ground installations for the Air Force, and they did a terrible good job of it. But they washed out on the cavalry.
When you would make these cavalry trips to Laredo or to Marfa, was it for training purposes, mostly?
Yeah. Well, the first time we made it was celebrating, they said it was the Mexicans 4th of July. I think it was in February, but it was some Mexican holiday that we went up there, and we went several more times. That was
was part of the mission border security.
No,
you didn't have to worry about that.
There was the only thing about border security at that time. Mexico was not at war with Germany, and we could not take anything to Matamoros, was our home away from home across, and we could only take $2 bills over there and silver, but no other bills could we take across the border.
So there were currency restrictions and
Germany never, they was making $100 bills or 50 and 20s by the ream, but they didn't
bother.
You would thought they would have made some $2 bills, but they never did, so we could take them with.
You maybe remember where you were when you heard about Pearl Harbor.
Oh, well, I remember that very well.
Where were you?
We'd been, I was still there at Fort Brown, and I'd had a 14-day furlough. We'd had a week early in the 41, and I had just got back from a 14-day furlough, and we was kind of sleeping in that Sunday morning, and the first sergeant came out in the troop street, and I'll leave out the profanity, but he screamed that them Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor, and I didn't know where Pearl Harbor was.
I believe you.
And this is poking fun of the cavalry, but it's about time somebody did. See, 20 years after the war, it dawned on somebody that we were the last horse cavalry regiment in the Army. And, of course, after we had been to Burma, and they sent us to China, and our 124th was no more. It was a National Guard outfit, but they just wiped it off of the books. they really, I don't think that they knew that they even had this cavalry outfit down there. They didn't know what, as long as Fort Riley was turning out these recruits, boy, it was a place to give them kind of little taste of war without sending them to Japan or to Germany. But cavalry training was good for recruits because they couldn't get in very much mischief. It's a lot of work.
Yes, sir.
taking care of I think it was seven men in a squad in a corporal, and we had 10 horses to take care of, and that keeps people busy.
Did you have to do everything for the horses? Did you guys have to do everything for your horses?
Not shoeing. See, this might be of interest. In the fall, I can't tell you the exact date, but in the fall of 1941, they extended this year that we had been drafted I'm not sure whether they extended it for 1 year or a year and a half. Anyway, it didn't matter because we had war in a few months.
Mm-hmm.
But when they extended this draft period, well, everybody, they'd found out that playing soldier wasn't an old man's game. There was guys that was drafted from Lubbock as 45 years old. They had to be single. But
right.
if they were single and 45, they drafted. Well, they couldn't get out there and run half a mile before breakfast. They couldn't run half a mile in a week. But you asked me a question, and I don't think I answered.
Well, I was asking you about whether you had to do everything for the horses, and you said, well, pretty much except for shoeing them.
Yeah.
You didn't.
Well, this when they, after they had extended this service for at least another year and a half, but they put a stipulation in there that if you were over 28 years old, you could go home. And all of our horse shoers was over 28 years old. And this guy, a good guy, he was a staff sergeant, and he's still alive, by the way, Louis Pizzo. And he knew that I would work, and he said, I want you to come and shoe horses for me. I'll give you a first and third. That means first class private, and it was the same pay of a sergeant. I think that same year they started giving you three stripes with a T under it. That was for technician.
Mm-hmm.
And I took him up on it just because it was sergeant's pay, and I worked for a week or so, and I wasn't sure whether I could stand it or not. It made my back hurt, but I got a 2 weeks furlough and I came home to Lubbock.
Uh-huh.
And I went back. Well, it didn't. Well, I guess the war helped me too, because the war was December the 7th. I didn't have, and they didn't know what they were doing after that. There wasn't very many horses shod through the winter. And we had, after 20 years, by people that was interested in getting together, we had a man, he was a major, I think, and a real good man. Name was Sadler. Didn't have anything to do with saddles, but but he organized this old 124th. We had a reunion every year.
Oh yeah.
Long as this man lived, that kid. Mm-hmm. But he was entertaining us to telling about the. They got a report that the Germans was going to invade Boca Chica. Does Boca Chica mean anything to you?
I don't know where that is.
Well, that's a little mouth is the name of it. Mm-hmm. But that's where the Brazos River goes out into the Gulf.
I see. Okay.
But there's a lot of desolate land out there, and we had army camps out there.
Uh-huh.
And but this thing that the major told me that, about one of his fellow majors, he was in the office most of the time, but he thought if he had to go out in the field, he couldn't find his spurs. He was crying up hell looking for his spurs. He'd been in the army for a year and a half, at least a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
But the job he was doing at the desk didn't
matter.
But to go out to fight the Germans, he had to have his spurs.
Well, did you take that seriously? The idea that the Germans might be coming?
Oh, yeah, well,
make a landing,
yes,
there.
We were on guard there. Do you know where the King Ranch is?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
We had troops up there, which is probably better than 100 miles from Fort Brown.
Oh, yeah.
But they were out there. I think maybe, I didn't go up that, but I think they might have had a communications tower or something there that they were guarding. And one time, I think that would have been into the next year, but Franklin Roosevelt took a train through Texas and went into Mexico to meet with the Mexican president.
Mm-hmm.
And of course we didn't. I was shoeing horses then. I didn't go, but they took all of our troops out there and guarded the railroad because they didn't tell us what it was till it was all over.
Right.
But Franklin met the Mexican president somewhere. I don't know.
Drew, what did you think of President Roosevelt?
I admired him of all others.
Why?
I don't know. He got people to work in. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was there was just nothing to do
during the Depression.
Well, they got people from the cities, teenagers, and signed them up, put them out. Maybe they was doing nothing, but they wasn't getting in trouble, and they give them spending money and sent money home to help those poor people.
What did you think about him? The way he ran the war.
Oh, if if whatever Roosevelt decided, if he told me to jump off the bluff, I would have.
Really? Really? What'd you think about Mrs. Roosevelt?
I still love her.
Do you?
Yes, I do.
How come?
Well, she had the good of the people at heart. She had everything in the world in her life.
Mm-hmm. She was an aristocrat.
Yes, that's right. She was raised that way.
Sure.
But she had a heart.
Yeah, and communicated that. Yeah, I think you're right. Well, Drew, at what point did you find out you were going to go overseas? When did that happen?
I decided I wasn't going as long as Fort Riley was in business, they would send their recruits that they had sent them down here, and they kind of was finishing school for those. And I met this girl, and so I got married in 1944, and she had some nieces that were teenagers, and they had it wasn't a family trait, but these kids had a table that they would ask questions, and they were convinced that. And I said, well, am I going overseas? And it said no. I wasn't about to go overseas, so I went back home, and part of my friends had already shipped out.
Oh, is that right? So
I never put any faith in a Ouija
board. Yeah,
I laughed about that because they was asking me to ask it anything.
Sure, know? Sure, yeah.
I had never been on a rowboat. I was raised here in this dry country, and you didn't irrigate in those days.
Right.
And I had never. One year we had a lake that flooded out there, and it stayed all summer, and we put two sideboards to a wagon that carried cotton, and laid that down and put a 55-gallon oil drum at each end, and that would float. Mm-hmm. And we spent all summer in our spare time rowing around that lake. And that's the only time I'd ever been on a boat of any kind. And when they sent us to Los Angeles, and our troop went on first, and we were going to guard the ship, and I figured on being seasick from the time that pulled out of the, and the first time I guess before a meal, I walked out there, and there was a little breeze, and way up here in the crow's nest, it'd go back and forth, and I said, I'd better quit looking at that.
Sure.
But we went to Bombay, India.
Is that where you? So you went from Los Angeles to Bombay?
We stopped for refueling in Australia. In fact, we stopped in Australia twice. Went around the bottom part of Australia. I think it's Brisbane, the first place we stop, and across on the west side there's another fort whose name escapes me. We stopped there twice, and there we had gone from Los Angeles alone. No other ship with us. We just took off.
Just the troop ship,
just
all alone?
Just the troop ship. Huh. And we would travel in a zigzag pattern, yeah. And it went quite fast. And we never saw any enemy ships until we got to Australia. And there we picked up a cruiser. I'm not sure whether we picked up the cruiser first or two destroyers, and then later on we got the cruiser. But it was one that we did have somebody with us from the rest of the way to Bombay, but we never did see an enemy ship there.
Did they, Drew, did they let you off the ship in Australia?
In Australia, yeah.
At Brisbane and maybe Perth or somewhere like that?
I don't think Perth is around the.
It's on the far end. Yeah.
The first one is Brisbane, and we could get off. It just stayed a weekend there, I think.
Uh-huh.
And
now, what did you guys do while you had your weekend in Brisbane?
You shouldn't have asked that.
I'll close my ears while you tell.
No, there was a. There was some of the. I was just a newly married man,
yes,
and
sir.
The Queen of Sheba couldn't have tempted me, but there's. Some of the boys was in the comforts of home, but they brought back a story about we had colored troops in the hold of our ship.
Is that right? Mm-hmm.
And mention that again, and I'll go back
okay.
to that.
Mm-hmm.
But. They went to a brothel, and this madam or one of the girls called this black man out, and she very crudely says, it's not my guy. Just soon have you as anybody else, but that's the law in this town. And but these colored troops went with us from Los Angeles, and there was a guy, and he was my name. His name was Anderson, and he came from Lubbock, and he was a troublemaker. He was a 6 foot two or three, and figured he could lick anybody, and he always was ready to prove that he could. But in this hold, there was a lot of fresh water tanks down in that. We were just to keep order, and somebody did something didn't please him. I wasn't down there. I don't know what it was, but he hit him up the side of the head with his. That's all we were armed with was a billy club, and it almost caused a race riot on the ship, and I I told my first sergeant, nobody wanted to go down in that hole. I mean, I said, I'd just as soon go down there as not. And I never had a bit of trouble with those guys. And I don't think that this big bruiser had any reason to have trouble, because I didn't have any trouble.
Mm-hmm.
There was a ship, an officer, I don't know how high up the ladder, but he came in and down in this hold and was giving somebody hell for getting into the fresh water. Well, I didn't. Well, darn me, I didn't even know that it was fresh water down there. I'd have probably been into it.
Right.
But he threatened and left, and not very long after he had left, a young black boy was getting down to the faucet and wondered he's going to get some fresh water. And I said, "You heard what the man said." And I said, "You, as long as I'm in here, you're not going to get into that fresh water." He backed off, and that was the only time that I ever had any even tell him what to do. But I wasn't going to have him doing that and get me in trouble.
Was it tense all the time on the ship, the whole way over, between the guys and
you mean between the whites and the blacks?
Yeah.
No, of course. I guess. I don't remember seeing the blacks up on the other floors. They were down there segregated. I never thought about it at the time, but I don't remember. I do remember we had the troop commander was the Jewish faith, but he was a nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in charge of all of us guys that were guarding it. And he told a story, and I think he was telling the truth. That he was on the rounds one day, and this black boy says, "I've got a problem." Says, in those quarters, all of the, if we had good quarters because we were guarding the ship, but there was a hammock like this, and it's just room for one man to lay down here, and then the one, there was about five high.
Sure. Yeah.
In
yeah.
That. And he says that this guy that's got the hammock just above me wets the bed every night, and it runs down on me and says, "Could you do anything about it?" He says, "Oh, I don't know. I don't know what I can do about it." Well, he says, "Couldn't you get him change beds with me?" Now, I don't know. I know that part's the truth, but I don't know whether he made this guy change beds. I think that was a reasonable request.
I have to agree.
Not asking for much.
Drew, do you remember the name of the ship? The name of the troop ship?
I'll tell you in a minute.
Okay, you probably tried to forget.
Forty years later, just that we were having a reunion in Brownsville, Texas. Mm-hmm. And this same ship was in the shipyard down there being broken up.
No kidding.
The one that took us over, Butner. I believe William Butner.
Mm-hmm.
B-U-T-N-E-R. But that was quite a coincidence.
That's a funny thing, yeah.
We were having a reunion there, and this ship that took us over there was being broken up.
Yeah, how'd that make you feel?
Oh, and not old.
I don't know, I might have been glad to see it go, but maybe not.
Well, I didn't. I just thought it was a coincidence.
Sure.
But I didn't have no fond memories of that ship. This was just a wartime era, you know. Mm-hmm. They made lots of mistakes. But that ship would, on a rough sea, it would come over. Seemed like it would be a 45 degree angle, and it would come back up, and it would never go on the left side, never go beyond perpendicular, but then it would come over. Somebody on the ship that claimed that they knew what they were talking about said that the ballast in the bottom of it wasn't right, but it never did capsize with us. But you get to thinking it was
something. Yeah, something's wrong here. Yeah,
it would never go beyond perpendicular.
Were a lot of the guys seasick?
Oh.
I know I shouldn't ask.
Have you got a strong stomach?
I do. I do. And I've been seasick.
Well, ever.
It's the worst.
And you know, when I got on that ship and I saw that mast going that way, I never got seasick, and everybody was seasick. Mm. And it came meal time, and of course, the fact that we were on guard, we got three meals a day, and the passengers that was getting peed on, they just got two meals a day.
Uh huh.
But I felt all right. I went down, and the chow lines were just deserted. But there was a line went here and a line went here, and of course this table was a little wider than this. Mm-hmm. But they met down here after you'd got your food, and we all went out together, and I went on the right side and picked out what I want. This guy's there, they serving it, but you didn't have to take all of it. And this guy came down the right side, and just as the lines come together, he got sick and he threw up and right into his plate, and it splattered over on my on my tray, and I just, there was a waste barrel there, and I just went back to my bunk and laid down. I it wasn't the sea that was bothering me.
Yes, sir.
I didn't want it regurgitating in my in my tray.
Yes, sir.
I got some. But I still never got seasick.
That's amazing.
We was on that ship better than 45 days. No, I'm lying. 35 days.
Tell me about arriving at Bombay. Did you know that that's where you were going to be ending the trip?
Yes, I did know that because someplace they told us.
Sure, okay.
I was a great friend of Rudyard Kipling. I mean, my admirer of him. And we're going to India. And as we approached the dock, a guy there with a robe around him and a turban on his head, there was a sidewalk by this great big building. I don't know the nautical terms of it.
Mm-hmm.
But he reached over, or leaned over, and let a mouthful of betel nut juice, just as red as blood, and it ran into the ocean. I think it discolored quite a lot of the ocean. As I said, I don't like that. Don't like that very much, and it got steadily worse after that. Now, I don't expect to make a lot of converts. But after we docked and I don't remember whether we marched to the depot or not. But we got on the train. And there was, I'll swear, 500 or more kids, say 9 to 12 years old, following us begging. Bakshis! Bakshis! Sahab! Bakshis! And I lost my faith in God. I do not think a just God could have that big a people with nothing to do but beg. And I haven't changed my mind since. I just don't think a just God would let people do that.
What did some of the other guys say? Did some of the guys give them money? Did you talk about it with some of the other men that were there?
You couldn't give them money.
Give them candy or anything like that?
Well, see, at the time, I had read, nobody had pronounced it to me, Bakshi, but that's in the Hindu language, they're begging for something,
sir.
Bakshis, Sahab. But I just don't think that a just God could. It's all over that whole.
Mm-hmm.
And this I think that the people haven't done anything about it. This AIDS epidemic is that thins them out.
Well, that's certainly true. as do other things like the tsunami and cyclones and all that. Right? I mean, they've got a lot to deal with over there, well, in addition to poverty.
You know, in the ice cap, I was in Alaska a few years ago, mm-hmm. and the one place there that was ever a few seconds, a whole bunch of a glacier would fall off, and since I was there, somebody told me that river is way back half a mile or so, or before it just came out to the bay, and that's what I was seeing this glacier calve in there. But the whole thing is warming up there. Where is that water going to?
Well, you're right, sir. It's raising the sea level.
The water is connected, and when they had this tsunami, or I can't pronounce it.
You
like
got it.
It should be.
You got it.
It shouldn't be spelled like. but we're not through with those things. We're not through with those at all.
I think you're right. Well, Drew, where was that train going? The train that you got on there at Bombay?
Well, there was a place I'll tell you in a few seconds.
Okay.
It was a training camp that you remember Joe Stillwell?
Vinegar Joe?
Vinegar Joe. See, the Japs run him out of Burma early in the day, and he took a of course, they hadn't had an airplane over there. The Japs would have took over pretty quick, but they took a lot of Chinese into Ram. Ramgarh was the name of this place, and I have never been able to find it on a map.
I've never heard of it.
I think it was probably just a village, and they put thousands of Chinese in there, uh-huh. and then we went. When we got over there, well, that was our staging area. Was Ramgarh.
Now, the Chinese were they laborers establish the camp?
No, they were
troops.
They were Chinese fighting men. Mm-hmm. And they went to Burma, and I don't know how much fighting they did. Mm-hmm. But getting there, they impressed me that they carried their provisions with them, and I would say a company, I don't know what they called it, but mm-hmm. 100 or so men, they traveled at a trot. And two of them would have a pole from their shoulder to the next shoulder with a live pig on that, tied with their hands and four foot in his hind feet, straddling a bamboo pole here. And they could trot all day, those coolies. Could with that that wasn't a 600 pound hog, but he's probably weighed 150 pounds shared between those two of them. And I imagine they had, after an hour or so, they'd change and put another one on there, but I never saw them making that change. Huh. It was always two of them carrying that pig going to the trot.
That's hard work. Now, were the Chinese troops, were they in uniform? Were they?
They were in Chinese uniform.
Sure, sure.
Chiang Kai-shek was, mm-hmm. was now, you know, nobody understood him. And
I think that's accurate.
Yeah. His wife come over here. She was well educated, and
yes,
and
sir.
she could present a pretty good place, pretty good. And she sold a lot to Frank Roosevelt about what they needed, and they did need it. There's no question about mm-hmm. that, but. Chiang Kai-shek, he couldn't. He just couldn't cooperate with anybody because he thought. I guess God had his hand on his shoulder, mm-hmm. and
that's why they called him the Generalissimo. Generalissimo. Did you have a sense of the politics in China? Did you know much about that then?
I couldn't make it. I don't think. This old my first corporal after we got out of basic training, we. Ride all day, and it would get dark, and then somebody knew where a water hole was, and we'd start leading horses to it, and it seemed like we'd go around in a circle. Everybody was pretty well at the end of their rope, and they appealed to the corporal. Pops Cullen was the his, they broke the mold when they made him.
Mm-hmm.
And Pops, what's going on? He said, I don't know. Christ don't know. So it's got him puzzled. We started to go from Brownsville to El Paso in a 6x6 truck. There's 100 of them. Mm-hmm. And Pops drank quite a lot. But he got sobered up enough he got on the truck. And this was in South Texas in June. And he woke up probably before we got to, we wasn't going to San Antonio, but about that far from our starting point. And we'd all hung our saddlebags with a full canteen on the bowl. These trucks were covered in canvas. He reached up there for the first canteen, and he unsnapped it and turned it right up and just swallowed all of it. Just before he got it down, this Elmore, and he stuttered, Pops, that's my canteen. Pops says, I know it. Why don't you drink out of your own canteen? Why, he says, I didn't bring any. I'm roughing it. Out of his drunken stupor, he pulled something funny out of it. I didn't bring one. I'm roughing it.
Well, you guys up in India were roughing it too, I think. What kind of setup did they have for you up there? Did they have tents or?
No. Where are we?
I was
back in Texas.
Oh, I know, but I gotta go back to India because this is pretty interesting.
They had bamboo. They built everything out of bamboo there, and it lessens the job a lot if you've got a lot of canvas to make
sure.
Roof. You know,
sure.
They had a whole bunch of coolies can make a shelter pretty fast when you've got a roof.
Now was it the 124th that was all together there? Were all of you together in one place?
Well, not together. I mean, we had the same objective, but mm-hmm. you know, each troop. Mm-hmm. We went along the same path, but we were separated. There was no man saying, follow me.
Sure.
It was just a troop.
No.
There was several troops that had come along at intervals.
Now, what did they tell you the mission was?
Everybody knew what that was. Before we got in the war, the Japs had taken all of the seaports in China.
Yes.
And so those industrious Chinese, they went out and built a road from Kunming, which is on the extreme western edge of China, mm-hmm. down to it across Burma to Rangoon is on the ocean,
mm-hmm.
and that worked pretty good for a year or so, and then the Japs come around and took Rangoon,
yeah.
And then old Joe Stillwell, he had been trying to wake Chiang Kai-shek up for several mm-hmm. years. They didn't speak the same language.
Right.
And I don't know why he went to Rangoon and got surrounded down there, and he and 100 or so men, they walked from Rangoon into India.
Yeah.
He wouldn't give up.
Yeah.
And somebody arrived at this. They were going to go to Lido and build a road across Burma, which nothing had ever been done there, and intersect this road that the Chinese had built. And what we did was walk from, well, somebody, the Mars Task Force had taken mules and walked down to Michinaw. It was just a village,
mm-hmm.
but that was where they were going, and they did do it, and they took it. There was an airfield there.
Yeah.
And that's, they flew us, when we got over there, they flew us down to Michinaw, which had been taken by the Americans, and the Chinese had a part in that.
Mm-hmm.
And there we got a bunch of mules and shot them up and took off across. If my memory is right,
mm-hmm.
I couldn't find my book. This man wrote a book about Mars men in Burma.
Mm-hmm.
You might have one. And
we may have it upstairs, yeah.
But we just took off across pig tracks, and we went to this place where the Chinese had built the road from and from Lido. Mm-hmm. This road was built to intersect. It was probably, I have no, 500 or 600 miles from there to Rangoon, but they didn't have no reason to go down to Rangoon anymore. This was just to get supplies into China.
Mm-hmm. And what were you bringing with you on the mules? Was it just your own provisions, or were there?
Well, we didn't even carry our own provision. Uh-huh. We were supplied by the from the air.
Airdrops
every third day.
Uh-huh.
I know it never. If we had started out with our own provisions, we'd have starved to death before we got there.
How long did this take? How long did your walk take?
You know, we didn't go to Sunday school. one day was just like the next.
Uh-huh.
But we started just before Christmas. We was we had two or three marching days, and then we celebrated Christmas. And
Christmas, 1944.
Christmas of 1944.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Did you do something special on Christmas?
No.
Nothing. They didn't.
Well, they fed us well.
Did they?
I mean, they fixed a Thanksgiving dinner.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
I think it was probably. We didn't have nothing but a field kitchen with us, you know.
Right, I'm sure.
And I don't know that we had that after Christmas, because we was getting meals ready to eat.
Mm-hmm.
But this wasn't meals ready to eat Christmas. We had
something a little better.
You wouldn't want me to argue who's this guy that used to finish 60 Minutes?
Andy Rooney?
Andy Rooney.
Uh-huh.
I always admired him. I really did. He wrote a book in the last year, and I purchased it as soon as I heard about it. See, he told about being in Europe when the war was won there, and they jerked him away from his roundup, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And he told about they sent him down to Burma, where this pick was built in that road. Well, in that, we ate Christmas, and just a day or two after we started the march, and we went 320 odd miles. Just across country, right uphill and right down. There's no pig tracks. People had before we started out, they put an ammunition cart with shafts in it. If somebody got his leg broke or if he was sick, why, they was going to put that behind the mule. And it lasted about a half a mile after we left the Burma Road. The trail was so that you couldn't get that cart around there, so we abandoned it. We had some guys that couldn't walk, but they had to sit astride a mule too. That was the only way we could get them out.
Really?
But but it was, this all happened in less than 2 months that we left Michinaw and the war in Burma was over. I mean, we had just wiped them out.
Yeah.
There wasn't many there to start with.
Mm-hmm.
But you know the dates when the war was won in Germany over Hitler. Killed himself and mm-hmm. and everybody quit fighting, but Rooney had to, they wanted him to go to China and report the war from there. But he told the story that after the war was over there, he went down here to see General Pick, and Pick took him out. And all of his road building equipment had vanished from the monsoon. But in that same length of time, I was right there on the intersection of the road to China and this new road, and it was going day and night. And I think he embroidered his story a little to, because it just wasn't time enough. Picks, bulldozers and so on that they built 1,000 miles of road with didn't just sink into the earth. There might have been one, two or three pieces of it that disappeared. But he said the whole road building equipment just disappeared, and that is, he just made that out of whole cloth.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't happen.
Hmm. Well, see, it's good. That's why we've got to do these interviews, so we can't let him get away with that kind of stuff. You know, we've got to. I'm serious. Well, did you see, in addition to your own unit moving along, did you see Chinese also moving on the trail, or?
Yeah, I did. And I don't know what impression this is going to give to you, but I think that this was after we had made contact with the Japs. We had some supplies dropped, and there was some Chinese. They were in uniform, mm-hmm. and they had packed mules, and they were coming to get this grain to feed their animals, and somebody from our side had told somebody to stand over that grain with a gun and not let those Chinese have that. Now I saw that, mm-hmm. and that was the first time that I ever saw that they didn't share that we had the same goal, but somebody didn't want. And it wasn't a general, it was some shade-tailed lieutenant, probably. They didn't want those Chinese to get part of our grain.
Mm-hmm. There wasn't a lot of trust there.
Well, that didn't make the Chinese feel very good either.
No, that's
right. They had been... taken every step we've made over those mountains.
Yes, sir. You're right. Now, what about you arriving in Kunming? When did you get to Kunming? Do you have an idea of when that was?
No, I don't.
What was it like there? What did you see?
Just a bunch of huts.
Yeah.
There was nothing.
Yeah.
Did you see, it was sometime this last year that National Geographic showed the skyscrapers that the Chinese have built there?
I have a sense of that, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I may not have seen the exact program.
Well, they had one that was showed part of Kunming like I saw it. Just a low... and they used a lot of hollow tile and cut it in the middle and make roof like that. I saw one of those on that thing, and then all of this new building,
all the
skyscraper.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, 15 years ago, I believe it was that long. What I remembered of Chinese was starving kids from 50 years ago.
Yeah.
But somebody, this was, I think, the Grange, you know, the Grange used to be a real good farmers organization.
Sure.
But
mm-hmm.
It's
kind of...
It's kind of Farm Bureau has just taken their voice away from them.
Mm-hmm.
But this somebody brought a bunch of pictures and showing this was before the Chinese started this one child to a mother.
Mm-hmm.
But these kids were well fed, and you could see they were well fed. It didn't look like the Chinese that I saw. And something I've read recently that this making the modern China, they just gonna let these old people out in the backwoods die off instead of they're not going to try to change them because they're setting their ways.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right.
I don't say it's right, but I think that's the way.
Well, but I think that's accurate. Yeah. Where were you camped when you were at Kunming?
There was at least 11, they called them hostels.
Uh-huh.
I never heard the word till I got there.
Uh-huh.
It was hostels.
Mm-hmm.
And there was I lived in two of them, not at the same time, but and the first one that I went to, they was trying to make an MP out of me because while the war was going on, I I was misplaced, but I was in an intelligence squad, and we had to walk out in front of the troops.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a guard dog, a man with the guard dog.
Mm-hmm.
And he walked 50 yards ahead of us, and we were ahead of the rest of them.
Mm-hmm.
And he had this guard dog that could smell an Oriental. I suppose Chinese and Japanese smell the same, but we was on the lookout for Japanese, but he stood out there ahead of us. And when we contacted the enemy, his job was over. He didn't. Well, after we had wiped the Japanese out, we got a medal and $10 a month extra for combat infantry badge. I've got one that I'm very proud of. But this guy that led the outfit 50 yards ahead of us, he was the quartermaster. He didn't get that extra $10 a month, nor the combat, badge.
Something's wrong there.
I thought that was the most unjust thing I ever did.
Yeah. Now, Drew, what was the contact that you had with the enemy? Can you describe that? Did you actually?
Oh, okay. It's not very. I'm not a hero.
Well, we'll see.
We had been marching for a couple of days, and we knew we was getting into the enemy territory.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a man, he shared my name, Anderson. He was our platoon commander. And he was overage in grade, and he didn't want to go. They didn't want him overseas. He was, I think, 36 years old. But he just fought tooth and nail. He wanted to be a hero. Huh. And so we had been leading the troops, and he woke us up one morning, and the enemy is right close, and we don't want these. We had four or five or six mules with us. We don't want them braying and alerting the enemy, so everybody gets up here and feeds those mules at the same time, and which was different because somebody usually fed them all, and the mules would, Well, I thought at the time it was a good idea, and it was a good idea. Well, we've got to, you know what a nosebag is?
Yes, sir.
Okay,
yeah.
All right. And we got them on, and while these mules were eating, here comes this guy that had been in, he was I'm not sure whether he was a first lieutenant or maybe a captain, but he'd been in the South Seas in several years.
Mm-hmm.
But he came back to Burma. They promised these Merrill's Marauders were the first ones in there. Everybody's heard of them. He joined them. And he really wanted to be a hero. And he and his intelligence squad, while our mules was all eaten by the numbers, they passed us and got in the lead. We had been leading this for several days, and Anderson thought that we was. Had the honor of being the first up there. Oh, was he mad? He was fit to be tied. But we marched all day, and it was a little stream. It wasn't as no wider than this from end to end. Mm-hmm. Here. And we crossed that thing, I believe, 50 times. And along in the middle of the afternoon, the shot rang out, and this guy that had robbed my Lieutenant Anderson of his glory was shot. And I'm still not sure whether it was the Japanese shot him or one of his own men. But well, that just put stopped the whole column.
Mm-hmm.
And we and the Air Corps, they had this hill right up here that had been picked out to send supplies into it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was nothing for us to do. This 6-foot stream was, there was just room for a man to lay down between that stream bank and the bluff over here. And so it got dark, and it wasn't bedtime, but it was dark. And we laid our beds down there and was waiting for somebody to tell us what to do. It would have been the day before, I guess, that we had got a mail drop, and it was, I had we had good mail service. We uh-huh. could send a message to Hastings, Michigan, and it was, I'd get an answer the same way pretty quick. Of course, they had some place where their air mail, they picked it whenever they give us a mail drop, where we'd get letters.
Mm-hmm.
I got a letter from her, and she said, I can't figure what's the significance of 16 roses. I had sent her sister, I think, a $10 bill. I think that's right. And so she invested it in the roses for my wife, right, for her first anniversary.
Sure.
And so I was telling, we was not whispering, but we wasn't shouting, but we was, and this kid, he was a cub reporter for the a Chicago paper. At home, I've got the paper that he was a columnist for them, but he volunteered to go over there. He was going to write the great American novel about the Second World War, and I don't think he ever did it.
Mm-hmm.
He died 3 or 4 years ago. But he carried on that trip across the mountain, he carried that thing, that manuscript. It is like a big telephone book.
Oh yeah.
It must have added 10 pounds to his weight. But he swore, here we are, don't know where the enemy is, and they're shooting at us, and you're talking about the significance of 16 roses. He wasn't mad. He was just why not take the war seriously?
Uh-huh.
while this was going on, the bluff rose up here, and the people that were getting our supplies, they were taking mules up here to where the airfield was. That was no part of that. We were reconnaissance. We didn't have nothing to do with supplies. Well, here come a mule with a pack saddle on from the dark up here, and he landed upside down in this stream. And he up and shook himself and took off. Well, this friend that called me last night, he was 19 years old. He just got into this, taking him at 18 then, and he was a conscientious guy, and he taken those mules up to get supplies. And one of them got away from him. He said, "I was up there all night. I was afraid to report back to Captain Pfeiffer that I'd lost the mule because I'd be charged for it." But he got back to where the other mule was, and that mule was there. And I didn't see that man. I knew him when we were in Fort Brown, but when we went overseas, he was from a different squadron, and I never did run into him. But just from our talking about it here, he found out what happened to his mule, and I found out where that mule come from. We was in the same war.
Yeah. Yes, sir. Well, you know, when Kevin brought you in the first time,
yeah,
we were talking about that plane trip that you made, where you were, I think you were resting, and someone came up and said, "I need somebody to go on this flight with me," and they made you a crew chief, I guess.
No.
Was it something like that?
I don't think so.
How did that one happen?
How did you end up flying into Indochina?
See, we started at Ramgarh, and we took a train as far as the wide track train goes, and then we got on a river boat, and on the Brahmaputra, and we was 2 days and three nights on that. Now, I don't know how much ground we covered because we was going upstream, and then when we came to the end of that, we got on a narrow gauge railroad and went to Lido, where we caught the plane. I can't believe wait a minute now. When I left Burma, we had got some new officers, and one of them says, "Take your men and go to the airport here and guard this place till we get everybody moved out of here."
Now, was this at Kunming or near there?
No. This was near Lashio in Burma.
Okay.
But we were going into Kunming from there.
I see.
See, everybody took their insignia of rank off while we were in battle, because the story was that they liked to shoot non-coms or general or officer. The generals don't go out there with.
No.
But he said, you're going to be here and guard this airport for 10 days for everybody to pass through here. And before daylight, the next morning, he woke me up and says, the officers played poker with too much to drink last night, and I can't get them up, and you're going to have to go. You're going to have to go with this. And he gathered up all of the odd people that didn't know where he could get a plane load. We went into, I thought we were going to Kunming, but we went into Indochina. And when we got there, this tall young man comes and he was looking for brass. He says, who's in charge of this outfit? And we took off all of our insignia of rank while we were in battle, and I thought, well, I'll just see how long I can get away with it without doing that, because everybody knew who was the sergeant. When I told him I was, I didn't have it. It was in fatigue clothes, you know, and no insignia of rank. But he took me at my word, because he couldn't find anybody else in the outfit that had any stripes on. But that was what I couldn't imagine me lying to you.
No, sir. that's how it happened.
That's what it was.
Now this flight was just a very quick touchdown.
Yeah.
And then
it was in the Hanoi area, and it was close enough to it was a battle area, and I got 5-star points, 5 points, a star for being in that area while the war was going. That's what these officers thought, that would look good on their service record if they was in. And I wasn't even supposed to be there.
So you got 5 points for landing
there? Five points for being in a battle area.
How long were you there? Any idea? How long were you on the ground there?
I was in India, Burma, and China, and mm-hmm. I can't tell you how. I guess from the time I landed in from the ship till I landed back at Calcutta mm-hmm. was about 13 months, I guess, because I was only gone 14 months. And of course, that one that was going home didn't take near as long.
It's funny how that is, isn't it?
They didn't go this way and that way. And I got a world's tour out of it, because we went back through the Suez Canal into New York, where we left from Los Angeles.
Yeah. Well, when you were actually in Hanoi near Hanoi for that very brief flight, how long were you on the ground?
Oh, a couple of days.
Is that right?
Yeah.
What'd you do? What'd you do during that time? Do you remember?
we went out and got drunk.
Yes, sir.
You don't strike me as a person that would read who wrote the Down to Earth about the Dust Bowl and the people went to California.
Steinbeck?
Right, Steinbeck. Mm-hmm. And that's what's the one I'm reading here where that I'm telling you about.
Grapes.
Steinbeck was the author, mm-hmm. but the Dust Bowl evacuees from Oklahoma. Who wrote what? Was that the name of that?
The Grapes of Wrath.
Yeah. I forget things like that. Mm-hmm. That I've known.
That's why you have us around.
Known for years. Well. It wasn't that book, but I'll bet you've read the other one that he wrote. There was a real young man starred in that and died right after it.
In the film? In a film?
In a film, yeah. Huh. It's the only film he ever made, I think.
It was a Steinbeck? Story?
Steinbeck wrote it, and it's and
what?
They were drinking Chinese rum, and said it tasted like rotten apples, but good rotten apples. That's the only reason I brought it in. Was,
no.
But that was what we was drinking, that Chinese. Mm-hmm. Well, it did. It had a faint taste of rotten apples to it. I had a friend that he shot horses with me, mm-hmm. and he was self-taught horseshoer. He went from Arkansas to Nebraska, and as a 14-year-old, and got started doing chores on a ranch, and he stayed there till at least 10 years, and then he got drafted and came down, and I learned more from him about shoeing horses than the Army had taught me. But we got separated, and I had seen him write to his mother in some little town in Arkansas. I forgot it now, but I wrote after I got home. Mm-hmm. I wrote to her. This is one of those where it's no address.
Right.
Just
the name.
Right, the name. Mm-hmm. And she wrote me a letter and said, well, Charlie hadn't made it home. I knew he had married a girl in Texas. But they moved to Nebraska, was where he had spent his life, and this place where he had worked all these years as a cowboy, they had no place for a married man with a family, and so he got a place on a farm, and then this guy, well, he needed a house built, and Chuck went out there and built a house for him, and then he decided that he'd work the place himself, so he didn't have any job, So I got him to come to Michigan,
uh-huh.
and farming went all to hell about the time he got there. But we remained friends, and uh, What did you ask me? What was it?
I forgot.
I forgot.
But I have another question to ask you.
Okay.
When did you find out? Where were you when you found out that Japan was going to surrender? The end of the war.
Well, I can sure tell you that.
Yeah.
I had got. They put me on. I was a sergeant of the guard. Every third day, I'd march a bunch of guys down, the guardsmen, at 6 o'clock. And I would sit there and answer the phone, which never rang, till about midnight. And then I had two more non-coms that they had finished out the night.
Now, is this at Kunming? Where were you? Is this at Kunming?
Yeah, well, yes.
Or near there?
And I developed an ulcer. It was nothing to do. That I did that for one night, and then I had 2 days off and nothing to do. and there was a guy came there somewhere. They had got a bunch of wax and officers. And they had put on Oklahoma, which was right new, and they had it toured the. And he was a hell of a swell guy, and he was on guard one night, the officer of the day, and I had a corporal, it was hard to hear it, and he whispered, But for some reason, somebody else was taking the phone early in the night, and they was going to wake me up, and I was to wake up the cooks. And this OD, officer of the day, was in there, and I woke up, and somebody was getting the dressing down, just as some general had missed a plane. And he was just giving this major hell. And boy, I come right up in my bed, and I had a watch. I had the only watch, but this corporal had. I'm sure he shook me the shoulder and said, "It's time to get up," and left. And when I raised up, my watch fell down. I said, "Oh, this is what happened." And I went and woke the cooks up, and they, I think, were already awake. But I came back to this, and the general had got, we were out. And I, this, as I recall, I said, I don't suppose it's any use of telling you what happened. Oh, hell, he says, forget about it. That could happen to anybody. So I thought he was a pretty good guy.
Yeah.
But he had just taken a great cussing out. I told him that when he seemed to be a good guy, I said, I just can't get along with this outfit. I'm getting ulcers. And so I went to his office and told him that, and he got the, flipped open his date book and said, 094 was covered horseshoe. That was a horseshoe.
Mm-hmm.
And I also, my general classification test, I had got 127 on it, which is 110 is non-com material.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, 094 with 127 says, you ran like Flynn. And he sent me over to a horseshoeing school that they were stuck. And as I went in, reported in to that place, there was a notice on that bulletin board that the first atomic bomb had been dropped in Japan. And, of course, a couple of days later, they dropped another one, and the war was over.
Mm-hmm.
So that probably just me transferring from this guard duty ended the war.
That was the end of it. Well, let me ask you one more question, Drew. What did you think about the use of the atomic bomb once you found out kind of what it was? What did you think about it?
If good they decision. Hadn't dropped that, if they hadn't dropped that bomb, we'd have lost as many more men as we already had lost in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Those people didn't know. They didn't know how to quit.
Yes, sir. That's true.
That's my honest opinion. I don't.
As you think about it, it was the right decision? It was the right decision, you think?
Well, in my estimation, it was. Of course, I might not have got into it because I was a long, long ways from Japan.
It's possible, though. You were in the right area.
Those guys, well, of course, I have to explain this.
Mm-hmm.
This intelligence reconnaissance that we were walking hot ahead of the columns, there was danger there, but after we contacted the enemy, there was nothing for us to do.
Right.
The squads that were organized for that, and they mm-hmm. went ahead and done it.
Mm-hmm.
And
I bet you were glad to see the end of it, though.
Well, yes.
When you arrived at New York, were you demobilized? Were you out of the army?
Let me see. No. We came in there, and of course, about the first thing I did at this was Fort Dix.
Mm.
I found a telephone, and called my wife's number, and she was at a movie. So somebody, well, this was a lady that Jean had boarded with, and she told me she was down at the movie, and I guess she told the operator that, because I don't remember having to. Well, I'm quite sure I called her collect. but she I called the movie and they paid sure anyway, got her there. She didn't have a penny on her. but the lady at the she trusted her anyway. She took the call, and then she there must have been some more telephone calls going in there because I went to Indiantown Gap, Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with
that? Yes, there's a big camp there. Uh-huh.
Yeah. But it didn't take but a couple of days that they one of the funniest things they said they stripped us to our shorts and a footwear, whatever you wanted, because there's going to issue you all new. And when the cavalry was disbanded in China, they said you can have these boots for a souvenir, the last boots in the army. So they said, this is all you're going to give you everything new besides one pair of footwear and your shorts. And so I wanted my boots, and I wore them into this room that had, oh golly, it was a big room, but there's a row of officers that would reach from this wall and down this and back here, and they'd all say, where in hell did you get those boots? They didn't, all that group of officers didn't realize that they'd been cavalry defending there.
Well, Drew, I want to thank you very much. This has been very, very instructive. Very nice of you to spend your time.
Well, you know what my time's worth.
Well, it's worth quite a lot to us because you've told some great stories, and now we have a better sense of what it was like to be there then and to see what you saw. And that's very important to us. And it'll be important as the years go on, and this will always be safe here. So you have my thanks.
I was telling, well, you're quite welcome. I was telling my uncle that Neville was very far from Amherst, Texas. Why, I says, you're in more danger. There was a road that goes past his house, and out in the country, nowadays they'd look because it's just a steady stream of traffic, but said you're more in danger going to your mailbox than I ever was.
Well, sir, you served the country, and it's important that we know that.
I tell you something. I don't have to tell you that. The first night we flew into Burma. I've told you two or three times.
Lacio?
No.
Lido?
It's Michinal.
Michinal.
And we flew in there, and somebody met us with the truck, and we went around, and we were half a mile from this, and I guess is the last Japanese plane that they had working, and it dropped a bomb close to where we landed, and there was a little Mexican boy. He was raised in Chicago. He didn't know anything about Mexico, but boy, he didn't like that. He didn't like that being he hid out someplace after that bombing and strafing went on. And when we got to the place where it was a sandy place, and he started digging that foxhole, and I was trying to tell him he was getting in more danger in digging in that sand. But he wouldn't stop. He was wanting to just get out of sight. And we had a few times it was an unidentified plane would fly over us, and we could see it. We would set on the side of our foxhole, and he was down here nearly out of sight. Cuss us for tempting that guy.
Yeah, you guys are making a target up there.
If that thing had come over us, I'd have been right down that foxhole with him.
Well, sir, thank you very much.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
Pleasure is all.